This podcast is brought to you by Amusement Warehouse Magazine, the industry's largest trade publication. We cover amusement parks, carnivals, fairs, festivals, history, safety columns. We really got it all when it comes to the amusement business. Only remaining print publication in the amusement industry on a regular basis. So if you're interested in what the amusement industry has to offer, subscribe today. You can subscribe by logging on to amusementwarehouse.com, carnivalwarehouse.com, or amusementparkwarehouse.com. Welcome to another edition of the Amusement Warehouse Podcast. Today we have the president and CEO of the Outdoor Amusement Business Association, Mr. Greg Chaco. Greg, welcome.
Good morning, Ron. Nice to see you. Thanks for having me.
Let me ask you officially, you know, I hear it butchered all the time, but how do you pronounce your, how do you like your name to be pronounced?
Chico, just like Chico and the Man.
Chico, like Chico and the Man. Okay. I hear people say different things all the time, so I never know what the right thing is. But we know, for all that are listening, it's Chico. Well, we both just got back when we're recording this from the trade show and the trade show week and all the things that happened down there. That's a big week for the OABA. How did that go? And you had some Hall of Fame inductees and all that. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was great. I mean, we celebrate all things OABA last week, and we really had a busy packed schedule, and we culminated with 300 people in the room for our annual meeting and chairman's reception. And as you indicated, we inducted Debbie Powers and Danny Houston into the Hall of Fame. And James Junkins was our recipient of the Pioneer Award. And it was really good. John Hanchin does such a great job putting those videos together.
Yeah, he does. Those are great.
Yeah, and it touches the heart every time, you know?
It really does. All the things that the people have accomplished, and you know, Danny, what he's accomplished is just in a world of its own. It's bringing a carnival that big and buying it and selling it, buying it, selling it again, and buying it again. It's just amazing what he's been able to accomplish. And Debbie, of course, has got to be your number one fundraiser there for the OABA.
Absolutely.
I was teasing her at the earlier little reception that you had at the museum. I said, Debbie, I'm selling raffle tickets. We're buying a plaque for you they're $1,000 each. But Debbie, for those of you that don't know, is always fundraising and hustling to get raffle tickets and different things done to raise money for the OABA. So it's a pretty incredible thing. And then James Junkins, what he's done with H2B, and he's just, he's got to be the guy that knows the most about that whole situation. And what's going on now with the H2B visa project that the OABA has been, I mean, it seems like forever we've been working on it because it's such an important thing. But what's the latest on that? Where do we stand?
Well, as far as the H2B world is concerned, you know, the Biden administration did double the number from 66,000 this past year. So that's good. Of course, we're still about 100,000 shy of the amount of certified labor people that it's certified that won't do American jobs. So some people get in their labor and some people aren't. I mean, you go into a lottery, Ron, you don't know. It's, you know, it's the whole problem with the system. So we continue to work with the Workforce Coalition and see, and anyone else that wants to talk about getting our, you know, our cap raised or returning worker exemption. And on the other hand, as you're aware, we've been working on trying to get P4 specifically for the carnival industry. For those that aren't familiar, the P category of visas is a category that's been used for years by circus performers, athletes, rock and roll stars, you name it. And we certainly fit within that category. We should have been in that category at its inception. And last year, I mean, we got 78 co-sponsors on a bill, which is amazing to get done, both Democrats and Republicans. And our goal was to try to attach that to something that had to move, probably an appropriations bill. And then when the Trump administration came in and took you know, both the House and the Senate and the White House, they decided it'd be better just to kick the can down the road as far as financial bills until they're in charge. And so here we are now in a new Congress. We have to get a new bill, and we are in the process of doing that. We just don't have the numbers yet.
And that, you know, that you just, I never thought about this before, but it just sparked a thought when you were saying it. But the one that exists now is pretty good for the entertainers and whatnot.
Yeah, they've been using it for years. There's no cap on it.
So you know, it's the only regulation. The problem is that we're not included as far as carnivals go. But is that that needs to be a whole new bill, or can that be done administratively by adding an industry?
Well, it's one and the same. I mean, basically, you need to have a piece of legislation that will add that, Ron.
So you do, because it has to be approved by Congress in order to get
right. And we don't intend to try to put that bill on the floor. We intend to attach it to some other bill that must go through. So that's where our intentions are.
I didn't know if it was like one of those things where the, you know, whoever's in charge of the visa writing in the actual department can, you know, determines what organizations are included under that.
No, they only do legislative rules when it works against us, not when it works for us.
Yeah. Unless we could teach all the H-2B workers to sing. We could bring them over. They could have a course. They already play soccer, right? They have a whole league down there.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
It's a lot. So that's a big effort. What's the OABA doing? I know people are going to Washington and lobbying their representatives and their senators and sending letters and doing all the things they need to do.
But what we found last year, and you know, thank goodness that this is the case, is that when our fair partners approach our legislators, it's much more effective than us. You know, every legislator knows their county fair or their state fair. They, you know, they go there to campaign and shake the hands. They used to kiss babies before COVID. They can't do that anymore. But that they relate to their county fair. And when the county fair manager or someone from their board asks them to write a letter or pick up the phone, they do it. I would say that half of the co-sponsors we received last year was on account of the fair partners helping us out. So, I mean, we don't really have to start over. We're on second base because the majority of those people that co-signed before will co-sign again. And then we just need to, you know, keep going and get as many as we can on board so that we can get this thing passed.
And is the new administration inclined to approve it? Is that something that, you know, because you kind of get a mixed message. Sometimes there's real hardliners on immigration and things, but you know, obviously entertainers and whatnot, they seem open to.
Yeah, well, the first administration of Trump was very adverse to the program, just basically what you just said. They wanted to do a comprehensive immigration bill. And even though this is an immigration, they put that into that category. Now, it's very interesting. Elon Musk came out with probably a month ago now how supportive he was with the H-1 program, because that's one for skilled workers, because he utilizes a lot of them. And yeah. Trump came out and said that he uses those same workers in his properties. Well, what he was talking about was H-2B. Obviously, he's not very well versed on the program. But what it did is it created a lot of situational awareness to the program. And in broad terms, they're very supportive of programs that bring people to the country legally, which mm-hmm. is H-2B. And it's not a pathway to citizenship. They come here, they work, they take the check, and they go home. So yes, we're pretty optimistic about the administration this time around, Ron.
But some guys do eventually become citizens, though, right? I mean, some of the guys have been in the program a real long time. I haven't heard about a lot, but a few of them have become.
They can, but it's through the regular channels. It has nothing to do with the H-2B program. There's no methodology. It's a temporary worker program. They go, you know, there's no. Right. Provision there to make them a citizen.
But I guess some guys come over and they like it and they go through the regular channel and they wait and they continue to work and do the things they're supposed to do. And eventually they do get some citizens. Yep. I saw somebody like got married or something recently, or, you know, got after they got their citizenship and everything else. So they were real happy about it. But, you know, it's, you know, it does seem almost universally loved, this program, because it does seem to work for everyone. The workers seem happy with everything. I mean, you hear, you know, of course, some grumbling here and there. Once in a while, there's some activist organization or something. But, you know, from what I've seen, they're very well treated. As a matter of fact, it's probably helped treat the American workers better in the long run, right? With the pay and the structure and all the things that have happened. I think it's raised all the boats, as they say.
I mean, this, Ron, the simple fact that they come back year after year says it all. And you know what? These people come here. The value of our currency in their countries is so much higher. In a lot of cases, it's taken people from poverty and to having their own home and their own vehicle now. It's like the best program there is. Everyone works out. We have a high demand for workers, and Americans don't like the transient nature of our business, and they don't want to work there. And these people absolutely love it. And they come, you know, they don't only come back year after year. They're trained. I mean, they know what they're doing. It makes too much sense. I guess that's why Washington doesn't like it.
and the other thing, I think, just for the general person, I mean, I think we know within the industry, but, you know, it's one thing finding people to work, right? And the transient, I'm talking about Americans, to get them to work. And it's another thing to also be able to meet the standards that most carnivals require. You have to pass a background check. Yeah. You know, you have to be drug and alcohol free. You can't, you know, and so once you, yes, you know, there's a small segment of the population that might work, but then when you lop off, you know, and you start applying some criteria to the people, then now your pool gets smaller and smaller until it becomes, you know, virtually non-existent to a certain extent. I mean, yeah, there'll be a few people that'll come in and enjoy it and take to it and whatnot. And I think we'll always get that, but can you find a whole workforce, you know, without compromising your standards or, you know, doing things you don't want to do with the public, you know, or having people on their show you don't want to have it. I think it's pretty close to impossible.
I mean, if you're in a major metropolitan area and you advertise, you're lucky if you get 10 people that show up. And then, like you just said, once they find out there's a background check and a drug test, you know, maybe you have 3 applicants left.
Yeah. You're almost better in a rural areas, honestly, than the.
Yeah, but I was just saying, you know, even in a metro area where there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, it's not there.
Well, it's amazing. So are you optimistic about something happening for this coming year, or?
Yes, we're very optimistic, and we're committed to making sure we get this done. You know, we just had our meetings down in Tampa, and everyone's on board. All we're waiting for is the bill numbers. We can't really do anything without the bill numbers.
It seems like they're just working on one big comprehensive bill right now, right? The whole, both houses or both.
Yeah, and we're trying to keep this issue separate from that because that's, they've been working on a bill for decades. They just can't seem to get that done. But I mean, yes, they're going to work on it, but I mean, we don't really want to be part of that.
And as far as the OABA goes, this is the biggest issue facing the industry, would you say right now? I mean, by far?
It is. And, you know, just ask the people that didn't get their workers this year. And, you know, we're an industry that the show must go on. And, you know, this is crippling in some cases that the show can't go on sometimes. You know, we have a lot of other issues in our industry. I mean, our insurance costs are soaring. Everyone's are, but ours in particular, you know, there's a lack of underwriters in our industry. There's all kinds of transportation regulation we'd like to take a look at. But until we get this problem solved, it's 100% our focus. And, you know, it's all win or die because there's no, you know, everyone asks me, can we put some measurement toward what we're doing? Well, as many co-sponsors as we want, but the win is the win. There's no in between. We need to get this done. And I saw a lot of optimism in people, you know, in Tampa last week, and a lot of commitment to making sure we get this done.
And this will hopefully solve the problem in perpetuity. I mean, obviously nothing's forever, but at least for the foreseeable future.
Absolutely. I mean, we still have to go through rulemaking, which can be painful. But if it's similar to what we've dealt with H2B, I don't see there'd be a big problem with that.
Could you teach a high school government class now with all that you learned about legislation from doing this type of thing?
I could tell you that Washington is not what the forefathers envisioned. I can tell you that much.
Are you singing, "I'm just a bill, just the only bill"? Because it is amazing how much people have learned about legislation from being involved with this.
And the trips to D.C. are very enlightening for people. To actually sit down with their member of Congress or their senator or their staff and see what their lives are like on a daily basis. I mean, I couldn't do that job. All it is people asking you for things all day long.
All day long.
And unfortunately, in some cases, they send you on your merry way like they're going to help you, and then you never hear from them again. So if the constituents themselves from the districts speak to them, and again, like I said, particularly the fair folks, we seem to get some traction that way.
Yeah, it really doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of downside because, like you say, it's not a permanent means to come in. It's not a, it's legal, as you say, and they have jobs and they're employed. And is the new visa different than the H-2B in that they're tied to one company or one place like that? Or will that be different?
No, that will be determined in rulemaking, but it's most likely it will be just like the H-2B program.
So that works out pretty good because then you don't have stealing back and forth and poaching of workers and all that, because that could pose a whole another set of problems with
people. Yeah, well, unfortunately, our government, Department of Labor, just came out with some new rules that were put in place right at the end of the Biden administration, which we and some of our allied associations have sued the government over. Because they changed the rules so that you can easily move from employer to employer now.
Oh, they did?
Yeah, well, we're fighting it. So, I mean, nothing's really been enacted yet. But that rulemaking does other terrible things. I mean, not that we don't want to protect the workers. Of course we do. But there was nothing in the initial legislation calling for worker protections. And this rulemaking is just illegal because they can debar you from the program now for having of any violation. And they go on back 3 years, and it doesn't even have to do with workers. I just heard of the other day that someone had a DOT violation, paid a $1,600 fine, which is nothing in DOT lands, and got a letter that he's going to be disbarred from the program because of that. So it's awful. I mean, it's just insane what's going on.
Yeah, the DOT things, just like your health inspection, they're always going to find something, small thing.
So it's just another thing that they're, that we've gotten thrown at from the bureaucrats to get in the way and help, spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to fight it. So.
Yeah, I'm shocked that they can, sort of cross-pollinate like that, like take a DOT thing and then use that against you. I mean, if your food stand had a health violation from, the local health inspector, could they do the same thing? That sounds crazy.
The way that it's written, it says any violation. So, yes.
What the heck? That is insane. I mean, I've always been, I always thought that the bureaucrats or whatever, the regulators, includes ride inspectors. I always think they should have to do the job for a period of time. 3 months, whatever it is, just to walk in the shoes a little bit to understand what it's like. I told the ride inspector a long time ago when I first got in the industry, he was, kind of busting on the company I was working for at the time. I said, when I grow up, I'm going to buy you a Carnival and I'm going to become an inspector just so I can follow you around and drive you crazy. Right? But, it's true because if they don't, if they're studying a book and they don't know how things work in reality, it makes it very difficult to be a good inspector. I mean, for a lot of people anyway, because you just don't know, and you can't, not that empathy should be fall in, but in a lot of cases it should, especially when it can, because, there's nothing hurting anybody and there's nothing life threatening or there's nothing causing major problems. So it's, I don't know how you do it, but there should be some sort of.
Well, the hardest part of that for people is that every jurisdiction has different rules, every state at least. And, honestly, we all welcome the extra set of eyes, but you're right. If someone doesn't know what they're doing, it's challenging. But I've noticed in the last 10 years, even, that the level of education for the inspectors has really notched up. And, you know, you go to NARSO and you see all, you know, the number of people that participate that in that now has notched up. And, you know, and quite frankly, I think that they do learn from our people because,
100%,
like you said, we do it day in and day out, and we know what to look for. And so that's kind of gotten better, I think.
Yeah, I had Wayne Pierce on not too long ago. That's what we were talking about. Because, you know, I mean, yes, I'm being a little cavalier, but not really. The, you know, the inspection part of safety is almost perfect. I mean, it's close. You know, there's very few accidents. And when you're dealing with something mechanical, of course, in rare instances, there's going to be something wrong. But the progress that could come would be from patrons, you know, teaching patrons that not to do stupid things. I mean, that's where you can really make a difference, except it seems like when there is an accident, they run right away to inspection again. But, you know, again, you're talking about the head of a pin, you know, that there's really not a lot that gets missed nowadays, like you're saying.
Right. So, like, you know, you could take your car from having a tune up at the mechanic and drive down the street and it can break down. I mean,
right. Because it's mechanical. Things
mechanical
are, you know,
things,
once in a while.
Things happen sometimes. I agree. But like you said, the safety level, the safety record of our industry is really very good.
It's incredible, really. It really is incredible. There's so many things to worry about, but, you know, getting hurt in a music ride is really not something that should be top of mind. Driving to the place will be much more dangerous than riding the ride would be. So so you did your OABA duties with the Hall of Fame. How many people are in the Hall of Fame now? You got quite a few.
Oh, off the top of my head, I don't have the number, but it's somewhere around 55.
55. That's incredible. And then you started the Pioneer Awards, of course. It was like Judkins, who, you know, played such a big role in getting this thing done, really changed the game with what needs to be done and what, you know, the understanding of the whole issue. And then, of course, this week, you know, everybody was back on the same week. Did it work out pretty well with everybody all together?
Yeah, I mean, the reality of that is our membership really liked the earlier week. And so we polled them and they wanted to, you know, go back a week. So we did it last year and then we polled them again and they said they wanted to go back to the same week as the show. So we accommodated that. But yeah, I mean, it's a full week that way. You know, you have the NYCHA food show, Fair Food food show early in the week. And then we get busier and everyone gets a chance to go to the fair and everyone gets a chance to go over to Gibbtown. So yeah, it works out good.
It's almost too busy. I mean, there's just so many things going on. It was like, I need a scorecard to keep track.
It's true.
And then God forbid somebody wants to start a new thing. It's like, no, you're conflicting with this one or you're conflicting with that one. It's really packed.
Yeah. Well, you know, the folks at the show, that's like their busiest week of the year, obviously. And that, and they have a lot of fundraising that goes on. I know one night they have a dinner for the museum and they have like a casino night. And so, they try to keep that bar full and their money flowing. So,
yeah, but I think it also brings out different factions. You know, like the, you know, larger carnival owners might be going to an OABA thing. The, you know, the workers or maybe some of the, you know, the game people and people that are more independent might be. It's good when there's, you know, it's like a fair when there's a little bit of entertainment for everybody. There's a little bit of something to appeal to all factions. You know, one thing I did want to ask about was I've been curious because you hear these numbers about the number of carnivals in the United States. And, you know, I think I've seen, I don't know if you guys put it out or somebody put it out, how there's less, a lot less, I guess, than there were.
Yeah, it's about,
I don't know what the timeline
is. It's about 50% less than there were in 2017. And a couple of our board members last year, and if the carnival had a pulse, like it still had a website, we would count that as still in business. So it was the numbers around 200, Ron.
That number
is a year and a half old. So it might even be less than that now because no one's coming into the industry. That's for sure.
I just met so many people in Gibbtown and sometimes during a year that are like new, like they're smaller now. Don't get me wrong. But I was like, you know, I'm like, how do I not know these people? Like they just, it seems like there's some kind of influx and maybe they're not considered carnivals or maybe they're, you know, I don't know if you consider, you know, 40 milers or sort of rental plus people at Carnival or not, but they're, I definitely see a few people, and I don't know where they come from or what they're doing or if they, how they get on your radar even, you know, to be counted. But, and then there's also been a little consolidate. I mean, you know, Danny Houston, a name, you know, they swallowed up a bunch of Carnival. So that's not really fair either, because they could be six or something like that, you know, in the past. Now it's one, I guess.
Right. But that's existed back to the Conklin days. You know, that's been that consolidation. But there is consolidation. I know that Degler just took a bunch of Mr. Panacek's states and some of his equipment. So there is some consolidation going on. You know, thankfully, the people that are consolidating are ones that are committed to staying, too. You know, I mean, their next generation is probably not going to walk away from that. But, you know, when you get to third generation in any business, that's when you see a lot of people exiting. And that's where we are. I mean, we have some people that are sixth generation. But
is it third, statistically speaking? That's a common.
Yeah. And it's like I said, it's not just our business. That's a generation that watched mom and dad and grandpa and grandma work so hard all their lives. You know, they've been on the road. Hopefully mom and dad have accumulated some money by now. So the opportunity to go to school or do whatever you want is on the table. And some people take that option. Thankfully, some of them don't.
Yeah, you see some of these, like, you know, I was talking to Rick Reithofer because I was watching his son a couple years ago. They had bought a ride and they were setting up. And, you know, like you say, so I guess he's one, two, would be fourth generation. But Tear Down Night in Gibbtown, that kid was out there watching the ride, you know, helping to tear it down and helping to get the thing done. And I said, well, you know, I'm sure he's, you know, his family has some money. He probably doesn't need to be here, but he was there. He was there and he's working and he had people with him. And, you know, I was just, you know, very, very impressed with Ricky and that he was out there doing that. And, you know, I think you see that with in some of the kids where they're really pretty involved with the business and you know, maybe even more so than their parents in a certain way. At least they bring a little different perspective to things. You know, they seem more serious about business. Some of the, and I'm overgeneralizing, I know, but it does seem that they're, you know, maybe brought some of the things they learned in college or brought some of the things they've learned from experience or the world and are really working it, which is good to see. You know, it seems like there's a vibrancy sometimes.
Absolutely. And, you know, first of all, our people work really hard. You know that. And there is some vibrancy to that and some fresh blood to that. And Ricky happens to be at the age where, you know, he's pretty much running. I mean, dad's still there, but he's hands-on running things. So our people are hands-on. I don't care if you're a show owner or anyone on the lot. People are hands-on. And when it's time to move a show, if you got a tight jump, everybody helps out.
Yeah, who was I talking to? Eddie Powers and R.D. Thomas. I guess they got a bad lottery pick last year, maybe, or the year before. And R.D. was like, my mom was out there, my cousin Fred out there. He's like, everybody was running the rides and setting things up and doing everything because they just were pitching in when it took time to pitch in. And it's, you know, I wonder because people ask, you know, or we talk about all the time about the H2B, if they didn't exist, would the carnivals be able to exist? And, you know, maybe I'm just an eternal optimist. I don't think it would be easy, but I think somehow they'd figure something out. You know, I don't know what they do. They'd have to downsize or whatever they'd have to do, but they'd figure something out to exist, you know, just because of the stick-to-itiveness that they have. It's just incredible. You know, pandemic and everything else, people found things to do. It's enlightening. It's really crazy to see people doing those things.
Yeah, I mean, our people are extremely resourceful. Like, you know, the show must go on, and it does. And they, you know, they don't show it on the outside of what they have to contribute to get that show open, but they certainly do on the inside. And kind of differ with you on the labor thing, though, Ron, because I think if that happened, it would be the end of our industry. It's just,
it'd be over, huh?
People are tired of this labor situation. We just got to get it fixed. And, you know, and we're doing everything we can to get that fixed in this 2 years of Congress.
No, it's got to get fixed. There's just no question about it. It just, I just was so surprised at how resourceful everyone was, whether it was the pandemic or something else. It was incredible to watch because, you know, having a business background, you know, you just don't see people doing the things that they did. I mean, of course there are people that do it, but as an industry, as a whole, it was amazing. People doing just amazing things, you know, seeing, wisdom, taking in all kinds of extra shop work that they were doing. The guys from Hitchhiker invented those sinks, you know, and pivoted to do things. Carnivals were doing all kinds of different things to stay, you know, not even stay on the road, but just to keep their people working and doing things. So it was incredible. And the other funny thing was, though, in pandemic was that some people got to enjoy some things for the first time that they never, you know, they're like, I actually went to my, you know, whatever, 4th of July barbecue with my family for the first time. You know, it was kind of fun to watch or listen to, because it was something you never think about it.
That's very true. And, it's funny. I think everyone in America's perspective on life changed a little bit. But in the carnival industry, it was what you just said. They had downtime. First of all, most of them didn't like it, like living at home all year. It was you know, they missed the road. We did have some legacy employees decide that they just didn't want to go back on the road, though. That's a given. And they were resourceful. I mean, I know a lot of them sold Trump merchandise, and a lot of it. And you know, everything from, you know, setting up a concession stand down the street from the house. You know, people found a way to keep busy, make money. Trucking was a problem, so a lot of people could drive. That was a good thing. And then, like, for the Comerfords, you know, everyone else could kind of curb their expenses, but the animals still had to eat every day. So, you know, it wasn't normal. It wasn't anything to do with normalcy. It just was a time that we had in our lives. I mean, I personally flew back from Tampa, and my next plane trip was to Tampa a year later.
Really?
We did a lot of, and it was great flying then, by the way. There was no one on the planes. We kind of recoiled, and we did a lot of Zoom meetings about certain topics to try to help people, and they were very well attended, because no one else had anything to do anyway. So, but it was a weird year. I mean, there was nothing like it, and hopefully, God willing, we'll never have another situation like that occur again.
Yeah, I was struck by the difference in the different states and the different takes and attitudes, whether it's a fair person or carnival people or whatever else, and how, you know, different everybody's approach was to a certain extent to, you know, from, you talk to somebody in Florida and then you talk to somebody in like New York or Massachusetts, and it was like they were on different planets. You know, it was like, it wasn't like the same world. It was so crazy to a certain extent. Then you had Delaware actually ran that year. I was a tiny bit involved with that. And that was fascinating to watch and experience and do. And I, you know, I have a friend of mine who owns a carnival that was in, I was just talking with the South Carolina State Fair lady, but he was in South Carolina when they closed in March, but South Carolina didn't have any laws that closed them. So they were open. And you know, like, he called me a couple of times. I was doing his advertising. He's like, I don't know what to do. He's like, nobody's closing me. People are coming. I'm doing fine, but the rest of the world's closing down. What should I do? Should I close? Should I, you know, he stayed open like another week or so. And then he wound up closing just because he didn't know what to do. He was just like, shocked or frightened or whatever. It was kind of crazy. It was a crazy time. No question about it. And Florida, I think a lot of people, you know, I even heard stories like in Michigan and other places where people actually operated a carnival during much of the pandemic. They found place to go. Some of them. It was kind of crazy.
Some of them did initially, but I mean, like you indicated, as the world kind of closed, I think a lot of people get off the roads. Again, what jurisdiction you were in would make all the difference.
It made a big difference, right? It was crazy. Yep. It was totally crazy. So your journey, you worked at the Big E for a long time, and you had some sort of family business or something, like a, I don't know what it was, a park or something that got you started.
Yeah, I'll tell you the quick story. My dad had a pretty good size retail garden center and Christmas shop. And I'm the youngest of four brothers, only one living. And my dad's dream was to get us an education, and we were not allowed to come into the family business.
Oh, wow.
So I had a brother who was an architect. One was a stock trader. One was kind of an entrepreneur. I got out of school. I was actually going to move to Dayton, Ohio to start a career in television sales. And my dad got sick and asked me if I could, you know, help him out for a little while. And he recovered, and that wound up being a 10-year run of running the family business. And one Thanksgiving, Dad said, "I really want to retire." I said, "Great, I really want to get out of this business." So
that wasn't the response he's looking for, I don't think, right?
We literally decided on Thanksgiving, and right after Christmas, we closed it up and sold it off and all that. And I was fortunate enough to if you're old enough, Ron, but there was a book that was called "What Color Is Your Parachute?" And it was a guide to trying to figure out where you wanted to work and what you wanted to do. Mm. So I went through their little quiz there, and I looked at it. And I said, "Well, the Big E would be the perfect place to work for me. It's not gonna go out of business. It's not gonna close and move to China." I was friendly with Wayne McCary because when I was in high school, I was the chairman of the Junior Fair Board, and he was our liaison. Wow. He wasn't CEO then. So I went and had a meeting with him, and he was in the process of trying to expand from 12 to 17 days. And he explained to me, he says, "I absolutely would love to have you work here. I could use help with the expansion, but you're going to have to wait like 12 months till we get this deal done." So I'm like, "Well, that's great, but I need to, you know, feed my family in those 12 months." So I sold drugs legally, pharmaceutical sales. And it was funny. It was on a Saturday, and Wayne had just had a board meeting. I don't know why he had a board meeting on a Saturday, but he did. And he was driving back calling me to tell me that I could have the job, you know, come in, see him on Monday. And on Monday, I was to have a meeting with my district manager from the pharmaceutical company getting promoted to district manager.
Oh, wow.
So I had to make a pretty quick decision there. And I picked the right choice. That's for sure.
That's great. What was your... You were sales or something?
I was a director of sales. But I also did all the legislative work for the company. You know, on a state level, we didn't really have a lot of federal issues. And I was the liaison to the Midway. I was always involved in OABA because of that.
Oh, okay. Very good. And you worked, I guess, closely with Conklin Shows at the time.
It was initially Conklin when I got there. You know, those were great people. I mean, you know, when Frank sold the company, that was really the only change, is that Frank wasn't around anymore. It was all the same people. And then that's what they call their international unit, Tony Diaz's unit. And then 1 year, don't ask me the year, it was probably 15 years ago by now. So our unit used to come in out of Canada.
Right.
Played CNE. And then it came to us. They had a major problem getting their help back across the border. They couldn't get their help back across the border. So they basically flew in people from all their other units to make sure we could run.
Wow.
Seamless on the outside, but wasn't seamless on the inside. And then so a few years later, that unit decided to stay up in Canada for a little longer. I think it plays in London, and it goes over to Tulsa now. So that's when we picked up basically Blake's unit, if you want to call it that. It was Jeff's unit at one point, but Jeff retired on us. So we have different players now, but it's the same show. You wouldn't even know it.
Blake's doing a great job.
Blake's great. Yep.
Had the opportunity. He's so much like his dad. It's kind of crazy. Their mannerisms and things.
He is. You know, Blake's a really smart guy. He's actually our chairman right now. He just came in as chairman of the OABA. And, you know, Ben Pickett did a great job last year. Mm-hmm. I'm really looking forward to working with Ben to continue all the things we started. And, you know, he's as committed as I am to getting this P visa category done. Blake's actually was chairing our government relations before he came in as chair. And he's a young man that's got a good education on what goes on in Washington. And he's doing a great job.
He does, huh? Yeah, Danny, when he bought it the second time, I was like, "Well, are you crazy? You've been out twice now. What are you out of your mind?" But he does a great job. I had him on the podcast not too long ago, and he's done farming, he runs a carnival for a little while.
Yeah, still lives basically in the same hometown he grew up in. So,
yeah. What a humble guy too. He's
very humble man. Yep, absolutely. Really
that must have been he was there during the ceremony the second time?
Yeah. He was definitely there for the main induction, and he was quite humbled and quite emotional, to be honest with you. He really took that Hall of Fame to heart because he's worked
so hard. It's amazing what he's done. I mean, I knew him first when he was a concessionaire with Pew Shows. He was a game guy. He was a great game guy and stuff. But and even when name kind of. You know, him and Jim Wegerle, they had the Mid-America shows, and they were kind of the second group that went into NAMM, and the smallest, really, of the stuff bought by NAMM, because they didn't really have any state fairs or anything like that, that, you know, the Conklins and the Farrows and the Blomses has had. So, you know, but then all of a sudden, Danny really, really stepped up and took a big leadership role, and then I don't know how he keeps track of the things he does. It's just amazing.
Well, I would say, as Danny always says, they have the best employees and they're very dedicated. And, you know, I just live by a model, too, that you treat people right, they'll treat you right. And
yeah.
obviously NAMM employees are that way.
Somebody's still got to run the thing, though. I mean, yep. he can be as modest as he likes. I talked to some people that, you know, work with them, whether it's inspector type people or other people, and they say, his grasp of that thing, because it would blow my mind. I couldn't keep track of all the stuff. It just, his grasp is incredible. So you got some, the Hall of Fame really, I mean, there's definitely some giants that have gone into the Hall of Fame, and, he's going to be, take his place amongst some really, really high level people. And
yeah. And if anyone wasn't there, all of the Hall of Fame that have videos are on our website. So,
check those out. They're really good.
I would advise people just go to oaba.org and find the Hall of Fame page, and you could entertain yourself all evening watching all those videos.
You really could. He does such a good job. I remember when Corky and Frank got in, they had a great video. It was really well done. They're almost like little mini biopics in a way, you know.
And in fact, Ron, some of the early inductees, or most of the early inductees, we didn't have videos then. They just had a script. And we're going back two or three at a time a year and creating videos from them. So
that's a great idea. I like that a lot.
Yeah, those that have just their picture there and no video, keep checking back. There'll be a few more. We're doing J.D. Floyd and Wayne Coots's father.
Oh, Al Coots, yeah.
Al Coots, yep. This year, so
yeah. When you get those done, send them over to us, and we'll feature them on the homepage or whatever, so people
there you go
can see it, because that's and they'll be in the museum too. Aren't those in the museum? Can't you like?
Yeah, there's a key. There's like a monitor there that you could just touchscreen monitor that you can do the same thing in the museum down in Gibbtown.
Yeah, those are fantastic. Because I've kind of been obsessed with the. With history, I read that Conklin book that just came out, and
I'm about halfway through it myself. It's pretty good.
It's a great book. You know, the only part that's a little bit boring is when they go through each season by season. It's kind of the same thing over and over, but it gets much better. I understand why he did it, but that John Thurston's a really good writer and did a great job. You know, some of the older books about carnivals, I mean, they're good, but they were clearly written by fans and not necessarily writers first, the fans first.
Exactly.
But Thurston really. He did a great job with that. And the archives that Conklin had are amazing. I mean, they had grosses and letters and all that stuff. It's incredible. It's a really good book and really good history. I knew some of it from, Frank telling me over the years, but I never really understood, where they came from and his real name, and he's an East Coast guy and then all Canadian. It's a fascinating history. That, hopefully doesn't get lost to history.
Yeah. Speaking of history, we're going to embark on writing some history starting this year. It was actually Blake's idea. I can't remember the gentleman's name, but there was a three series of books that are published. I think the last one was in the late 70s, maybe, that really chronicled the history of many different carnivals to that point. But no one other than that, the book you just talked about, Carney King, no one has chronicled anything since then. So we're going to embark.
I think Straits has a book, but I'm not 100% sure. I think there's a Straits.
Yeah, but not comprehensive of the industry.
You know, oh, really? Everything. I haven't read it. I just know there was one.
So we're going to embark. I don't know how long it's going to take us, but I'm basically writing a book from when that one left off to today.
Oh, cool.
So we have
like part four or something.
Yeah, so we have something chronicled, and we're still in the early stages of it. We just approved it at the board meeting in Tampa. So,
well, that'll be great. When did the last one leave off?
I think it was late 70s, something like that.
Oh, so you got a big, really the 70s, 80s was when the rides really blew up. You know, the big ones were out there. I didn't really realize until I read the Conklin book, and I probably should have known, but I didn't. But how much the industry has just changed in the last, 40 years even, it's incredible. It's like a different industry completely. Up until the 70s, it was still, there were some rides and they were getting a little better, but it was really in the 80s that things really, really changed with a lot of these big European rides and all of the modern carnival really started to exist.
Right. No, that's true. And I mean, everyone, notched up their game. You saw uniforms on people. I mean, we developed a circle of excellence that helped people notch up their game. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're right, Ron. 40 years, carnival's changed tremendously. And you know what? Probably 20 years from now, it's going to look completely different again. So
it's amazing. I mean, we do some shows on sideshows and things like that just not there anymore, don't exist. But it was everything,
Well, yeah.
Prior to the 40s, let's say.
If you go back, everyone used to be they called themselves shows because that's what they were. I mean, it wasn't until the World's Fair in Chicago that really mechanical rides were even developed. So that's all they had is shows. They're kind of more like a circuses. And it's now, obviously has changed completely from that. It's all about rides, high tech rides.
Yeah. And there was really only a Ferris wheel and a merry-go-round for a long time until the, until well into the 19th or 20th century. I just had Patty Sullivan on a podcast talking about Eli Britt. I mean, what fascinating, 125 years and the things that I guess it's her great, great grandfather did is just amazing. She showed me pictures of a gondola wheelie developed in like 1919, like a modern, I was like, what the heck? I guess it didn't catch on or something, but it was like a modern chance wheel. I mean, not exactly, but close.
Yeah, I got you.
The things they made were just mind blowing. And then as the carnivals developed and game rides and shows, and you read that in the Conklin book about the shows and how many shows they're going to have. And buying a ride was like there was just a few of them. So it wasn't really that big a deal. And even buying a ride back then was incredible. They'd write a letter. Hey, I would like to buy your scrambler. How much? And then he'd send the letter and the letter would come back. Oh, it's $8,000. Okay. I'll give you $8,000 and I'll meet you in May in Tupelo or something. And then they're like, okay. It was, cause you take it for granted, that you could just call somebody up now and talk to them and do whatever you're supposed to do. But back then it was a chore, I guess, to do it, but they survived. Like I said, it's impossible at first to think about it, but they survived, right? They did it.
Yeah, absolutely. So must go on.
The OABA works closely with the IFE on a lot of these things, as you alluded to before. Have you had a chance to meet the new, are they the president and CEO over there?
Yeah, David's a great guy. He actually, we were together for the Vermont, New Hampshire Fair meeting up in New Hampshire.
Wow, that was like the biggest one-day thing ever. All these celebrities there.
And then he was in Florida, for the whole week. And yes, we've had conversation, and we totally get the fact that there's a lot of synergy there, and that synergy will help both of us in the long run. And we participate. I mean, one of the reasons I was brought on board is because I had a fair background, and we've really notched up the relationship, obviously with Marla, but now with David. They're doing a study on economic impact that the fairs have across the country, and they're going to get it done this time. But we contributed substantially to that program and others. But yes, we're very much close. I'm going to talk about that program for a second. David had just announced in Florida that apparently Pennsylvania had just done their own economic impact study on the fares in the state. And I believe the number was, the economic impact was 1.3 billion with a B in just Pennsylvania. So imagine what the impact must be if you add 49 other states into that. And those are numbers that are, yeah, those are numbers.
You know, I went over one of those once and it's been a while, but you know, I have an MBA and I was used to writing some reports like that I worked at a hospital for a little while. And they didn't include the carnival in a lot of ways. I mean, they said like ticket sales and taxes, but I was like, well, what about, I saw like a, just before it was published copy. And I was like, well, what about all the tires they buy? What about, you know, the 200 people that work here that go grocery shopping every day like they do, and the hotel rooms they buy? And so they, you know, added some more money onto the number because they didn't really go over the carnival's impact, the gas, the fuel they buy, the, you know, right, all the things that they did. They didn't really, because it was a tremendous number when you really, you know, especially when you break it out in individuals, it was a tremendous number that they
yeah. Had. Well, one of the side benefits of them doing that is they're going to be able to extrapolate out the carnival. So we'll know what our economic impact is across the country.
Yeah. But who's ever's doing it got to realize that the carnival actually does spend those things, because a lot of them don't get it. You know, it's a tremendous number. All those people eating and doing stuff. It's just incredible. Buying things. And
so if any fair folks are listening to this, make sure you turn your survey in.
That's right. Include your carnival with what you're doing. We didn't really touch though on, you were working at the Big E and you worked at the Big E for a long time. So when this opportunity came up, what drew you to it? And, what were you nuts?
Well, it was kind of interesting.
How carnival guys.
So what they did was, they had a committee. EJ Dean was the chair. I forget what they called it. It was a funny name. And what they did is they challenged the board to reach out to people that they thought would be good and what might have an interest. So I had like 3 or 4 board members, you know, reach out to me. And I said, I have absolutely no interest in living in Orlando, Florida, none whatsoever. And the response to that was, I don't think if anyone cares if you live in Orlando. I mean, reality is a cell phone and a laptop. I could do this, you know, up a tree if I wanted to. So I went through the interview process. You know, Bob Johnson had been a good friend of mine for many, many years. It's funny. I was at the Big E for 24 years, and Bob was at the OABA for 24 years. So,
oh, wow.
So we interviewed at IAPA in November. And I was offered the job at the IFE convention in either later November, early December, and never looked back. I just had my sixth year anniversary. It feels like I just started here yesterday. But I love the job. I love the people. You know, they're all straight shooters. They're all smart family business owners, and there's no flies on any of them, as my dad used to say.
Yeah, no, you got, you know, the carnival guys now, I remember, because I worked for Amusements of America, Dominic Vivona was the, whatever you call it, the chairman or the president or whatever, in the time when they fired Raleigh Larson at the time. And back then it was, you had some big personalities on that board. I mean, big. And there was a lot of politics. It was not... I think Bob, you know, was able to smooth that out a little bit over the years and make it a little bit more, you know, I don't want to say professional, because I think they were professional in a way, but there were some big personalities that were really tough to overcome in some ways. I think that's, there still great people.
It's an interesting phenomenon, because everybody in that room is a competitor.
Yes.
And they're sometimes fierce competitors. But when they walk into that room, they really take that hat off and they put a hat on that is for the benefit of the industry and the benefit of all. And, you know, I applaud them for doing that. It's not an easy thing to do. Do they still have opinions? Yes, but they keep their personal gain opinion, if you would, out of the conversation. And, you know, sometimes we have to make some pretty hard decisions. And I'm glad I have a resourceful, smart group that can make some of those decisions.
Yeah, you have a really good group working together, which is important, like you said, because there was definitely a little, you know, it was definitely a little contentious back then with the different factions and different people. It was kind of crazy. I remember Dominic got up there and he chaired his first meeting, and then they went through the process of making motions. He's like, I didn't even know what's going on. And they started, and the next thing I knew, he's fired. He's like, Robert's Rules of Order, you gotta brush yourself up on him. But it was interesting. It was definitely interesting. And you know, that whole but somebody had the vision and the foresight, Mr. Straits and John Vavona and I forget the other guy's name. There were a few of them that started that thing, because they, even then, they were looking out for the good of the industry. They needed to band together
organization for everyone. We just ran an article in Showtime, and the title of the article was "It All Started with a Crowbar," and it started with a crowbar that some union guys put into Mr. Straight's radiator because they wanted the unions to have those carnival jobs, and that's the original reason why they banded together. Was to stop the unions. It was in the Chicago area, I think. And I think they must have just figured out, well, you know what? We got a lot of other issues that are important. If we work together, we could probably solve them. And I would have loved to have been a fly in a room back then too, Ron,
John told me that the unions, they were scared of them at first, but then the union said, you know, if you need a Skywheel foreman, we'll just send one. And they were like, okay. And then for a while, they kind of tried to do it. And then the union just said, forget this.
It's too much work.
We can't do this. It's too hard. So that turned out to not be too big of a threat. But, I think they realized there were other overriding issues or other major issues facing the industry. And so they kept it going for so long. And there's such, you know, legends
You say that, because Blake, in his opening, his remarks when he became chair, read a passage, must have been from the history book I was referring to earlier, about what life's on the road with and labor problems and, you know, costs going on, all the things we face daily. And then he told us that the passage was from 35 years ago.
You know, it's funny. We had that conversation at the Indiana convention. So I had read the Conklin book, and they were talking. I brought it up to him, and he's like, that's funny. I'm just writing something about that, because the same issues, I mean, it might be a different cause or whatever, but like one thing that really struck me was like the war. They said, well, after the war, we had to close, a lot of things had to close. And then there were supply chain issues. And then there was, you know, shortages and blah, blah, blah. But the grosses went up and they stayed up. And I said, I wondered, you know, pandemic side, same thing, right? Basically, supply chain issues, all the problems were the same. And then the grosses went up, and because a lot of us were wondering, is this going to be a one-year thing or is it going to keep going? But it kept going, and it kept going after the war. So you can learn so much from history and the problems, like you said, you know, whether it was, you know, your horse didn't work or your train didn't work or now your truck doesn't work because of regulation or something else. It's the same thing. It was just transportation, right, in a broad sense. So, you know, the issues are the same. They never really stop being issues. I guess maybe labor might be something that's a little different, but because you never hear too much about labor back then. But all the other issues seem to be just recycled issues from the past that just have to be come out in a different way than they were then.
Yep.
It's really amazing.
They say history repeats itself. There you go.
And it's so true. It's so true. I mean, it's comforting in a way to read those histories, because you see what they were dealing with and what they were dealing with. And, you know, forget it. They didn't have phones and faxes and all the thing that we have nowadays, you know, to communicate and do all the things that we could do. We're lucky in a lot of ways. You know, back then they had to really work hard, and your word had to be like super tight, because, you know, if you were unreliable, forget it. Nobody would deal with you. You know, it'd be all over. Exactly. That's incredible. So, you know, we got about a minute left, actually, believe it or not. I feel like we didn't cover like half the things that you got going on, but what are some of the challenges you got facing the OABA? And again, are you nervous about anything? You're pretty optimistic about the whole situation.
Well, insurance is a cyclical business.
Yeah.
And we're in the bad part of that cycle right now. Insurance costs are just soaring. And I know it's happening to the fair industry as well. The problem is we just don't have enough people underwriting. And so, we're faced with soaring insurance costs, which is really one of the biggest problems we have right now. And then, you know, the other thing we're working on is indemnification, you know, in the litigious world that we're in now, something happens, everyone gets sued. I mean, everyone gets sued. And so we need to start writing our contracts a little bit better that protect both the fair and the carnival, so that if someone trips in the parking lot, the carnival is not getting sued. I mean, they're going to sue everybody anyway, but just an easier way to get out of it. And same thing, with the fairs. If someone gets hurt in the midway area of the fair, I mean, we should have indemnification clauses and hold harmless clauses that just make life a lot easier for everybody.
I got a crazy question for you that I never really asked anybody, but I've been really curious about. With the independent midways, right? They book the rides and they have everything in there. And each ride company has their own insurance. But, could an argument be made that, like, the fair is in charge of running the midway? And,
ride insurance. Like I said, everyone's going to get sued anyway. So,
But most of those insurances don't have ride insurance. They're excluded from rides. Unless those independent fairs get ride insurance, I'm not really sure, honestly.
Well, of course. Yeah, you're not getting into any fair in this country without insurance. I mean, each independent ride will carry their own insurance. And then I'm sure that, the fair itself obviously has insurance.
Generally, those are excluded. Rides are specifically excluded from those type of policies.
Yeah. I'm trying to think back in my Big E days. I don't think we had any ride exclusions in there.
Because you had Conklin and then they had an umbrella and you were set. But here, I think with an independent midway, you could make an argument that they're in charge of the rides and the placement and all those things. And I wonder if that's going to be a problem one day with insurance or something like that. But
yeah, I mean, the people that run the fairs that have independence are pretty smart folks. So I'm sure that they've got that figured out. But I'll inquire next time I talk to one of them.
Yeah, because I'm real curious, because if it did run up to that level, and they're excluded, that could be a big problem. That could be a big problem. Because I think you could, some lawyer can make an argument that they're in charge. They determine where things go. They determine what time they open, all those things.
No, so I totally get what you're saying. I'd have to look at it. I never even thought about that.
I stay awake at night thinking of these things. Greg, thank you so much for coming on from Massachusetts. I think you're going to be warmer than it is in here in Virginia. We're going to get about a foot of snow tomorrow, supposedly.
Oh, boy. Yeah. No, it's been a cold winter. Not a lot of snow, but definitely.
It really has.
Yeah.
Best wishes for a great season. If there's anything we can do to help, and please send us those videos when you make them. We'd love to showcase them.
Yeah, absolutely. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much. And appreciate you coming on.
Talk to you later.
This podcast is brought to you by Innovative Ticketing is the ticketing source made for the amusement industry. Our staff of professionals can guide you through your setup, assist with customer service, even on the weekends when you most need it, and help increase your sales through promotions that work. Innovative Ticketing is the ticketing source made for the amusement industry. Sign up today at innovativeticketing.com.